base crashes in. You know, it's time to begin, and wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we are so glad you have chosen to tune in to DLC. Especially if you are one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run out there bettering yourself. We're going to help best we can try to get you through with some gaming goodness in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes, because DLC is your downloadable conversation for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors, Blue Apron, Untuck It, and Sherry's Berries. They're bringing the show to you. DLC, of course, the show all about games and their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis, the guy who is the soul gem in my Infinity Gauntlet, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, audience. Oh, I thought maybe I was going to be your Game 7 or some basketball-related thing, but no, You went for the movie that no one has seen. I am shocked at how poorly Infinity Ward is doing at Infinity Ward.
Infinity Ward.
Infinity Gauntlet that's is where, doing at the box office.
That's where Thanos has all his babies, at the Infinity Ward.
Well, that's where he also is making the next Call of Duty there.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, big week for all kinds of things, including that movie. And really, we're going to have some fun things to talk about. We got cool news. We got a big game announcement. We have games we've been playing. But man, if you're talking Marvel, it's the perfect week to have this guest back. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I'm excited because once again, DLC stands for Dazzler's longtime champion, because you know him as former writer at Insomniac and at Machinima and all over the place, really. But I know him as the biggest Dazzler fan on the internet. That's Marvel's Dazzler, Mr. Brandon Winfrey. Hello, Brandon.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for that intro. Yes, I mean, no spoilers, but when Dazzler showed up in Infinity War, I was shocked.
You must have gone out of your mind.
They got that cameo in Rogue. I'm surprised they didn't do another Fox, property, but, they went right for Dazzler.
My understanding was that's the entire reason they purchased Fox, was to get Dazzler.
Absolutely. It was a good purchase on that part.
Is this where I announced that they officially purchased an option to my Dazzler Jubilee script? Because it's happening, you guys. It's
Dazzler. Jubilee, the pairing we didn't know we wanted.
It's called Dazzler Jubilee : all of the lights.
Light of the night. Yeah. Perfect. Another great reason that Brandon is a guest this week is because he grew up, born and raised in Memphis.
Yeah.
And Christian, you just got back from Memphis, right?
I did. Yeah, I wanted to talk about this a little bit. I was visiting St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. They flew me out there to kind of do a tour of the hospital and play some games with some kids and see what the doctors are doing in the research and just kind of talk about it. I've been a big fan and supporter of St. Jude for a while and have raised some money for them over the years. And each year, this time of year, they do a big event, play live event, where they bring a bunch of gamers in and streamers. And it's kind of a big fundraiser for them where they realize the reach that this generation can have and that video games can have and the positivity that gaming can bring to kids. And
they brought you in to dunk on some kids in the hospital?
No,
just to school them with your mad PUBG skills or something?
We played Smash and Mario Kart, and let me tell you, those kids are good at Smash and Mario Kart.
Yeah, I don't doubt it.
What characters do they gravitate towards in Smash? I'd actually be interested.
There was a lot of Falcon in Smash that was being played. There's a lot of, don't blank on me now. There's a decent amount of Mario, but not that strong of Mario game. Right. My Pokemon knowledge, Charizard. Yes. I would say him and Falcon were the two main dominators in Smash for playing on Wii U. And then Mario Kart. Mario and Peach were just dominating the dojo. But I'm doing it again for this month, starting now until the end of May. I want to raise $5,000 for them is my goal. And I think we can do it. I would love your help. The link is a little annoying, but I'll have it by the time you listen to this, I'll have it on my website. So you can find it at christianspicer.com, but your donations go 100% to St. Jude. They're 100% tax deductible. And I have some fun, silly milestones in there that if we hit these things, I'll, dye my hair blonde, dye it pink.
Wow.
Shave my head or buzz it down to a 2.
I don't think you even needed to add those things. Just raising $5,000 to get you to go to Memphis to get schooled by a bunch of children again. I think that sells itself, honestly.
Yeah, and I'd love to do it with $5,001 donations, to be perfectly honest. It's like the power of many helping others. And right. I'll talk more later on ALTMM or on my Twitter about what I like about St. Jude so much. But all of the research they do to help kids fight cancer is given away freely to other hospitals around the world so that they can benefit. And every child that goes there, they pay for nothing, absolutely nothing. Them and their family, food, travel, expenses, lodging, all of the medicine, all of the care they receive. And it's really, really great work. So I encourage you, to help me, raise money so that these kids can beat cancer. And again, I'll have a link on my website, christianspicer.com. I'll also have it pinned at the top of my Twitter, which is at Spicer. And also, Brandon, Memphis, man, that pyramid.
Yes.
What? There's a real pyramid there.
There is a pyramid. It used to be something, and now it is a corporate empire, essentially. I tell you, I went there like the first month because it was a big deal when that – basically, there's a pyramid there. It used to be a stadium. Then it wasn't. And now it's a, Bass Pro Shop world. And when I say world, it's intense. It is a destination for that city for people
there's
to go
a,
there.
There's a swamp in it with like mm-hmm. boats floating. Like it's a thing.
Yes, just like the real pyramids, swamps with boats. Authentic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's massive.
Yeah. Well, you know, we always end the show by saying make the world a better place. I think this is a great way to do it. I'm so excited to, lend my support and my dollars as well, Christian. So, I hope lots of our listeners do as well. So again, christianspicer.com is where you'll find that link. All right. Let's jump into the show and start the way we always do with story of the week.
Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by visiting our subreddit, which is 5x5dlc.reddit.com. And there's some interesting stuff going on this week. Brandon, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Well, since Square Enix invited me to go out and see Shadow of the Tomb Raider, their first reveal, I guess I will choose that because it's a new game in a AAA franchise, and that's always worth some news.
Yeah. Does it have pyramids?
Even, there were no pyramids in there, actually. I know what they have in Mayan culture. But yeah, so I think this was Thursday night is when they did their reveal for mm-hmm. the game, because obviously, shock everyone, there's a third Tomb Raider game coming out September 14th, I think.
That's right.
Yep, September 14th. And yeah, I got there. It was, A, it was at the mine, which is a place downtown. Very fitting. It looked amazing, of course. But then the actual, what they're doing with the game, I think looks interesting. Because essentially what they're saying is this is the conclusion of this Lara Croft trilogy, of her like becoming Tomb Raider.
Yeah, it's like her origin trilogy, right?
Right. Yeah. So the things they've evolved is they were like, okay, the first one, it was kind of new. And then the second one, like we expanded the world, like as far as like her gathering resources and stuff. And now it's about her dominating the world. So I think,
wait.
Yeah, which is, I don't know. She just bow and arrows everything.
That sounds like a bad crazy guy, you know, like.
Well, yeah, but also I think that goes in correlation with like the emotional arc of this one is it's like, okay, Laura's killed a lot of people for two games. So now this game, she's going to be like, what have I been doing? And kind of, which honestly, I've thought has been a lot of the games have kind of dealt with that, but this one apparently has it more head on, in its approach. And naturally, overall, it's a darker tone, I would say. Something they wanted to do is make the tombs terrifying. That's actually, from the gameplay, I played about 45 minutes of it, and I can definitely see that. I can definitely see the tombs, how scary they are in, you know, conjunction with opposition to the last ones, which still cool and bright, but these want to scare you, which I think is cool. And also I think.
Are we talking like jump scares? Or are we talking?
No, I'd say just the aesthetically, like maybe jump scare wise, but like aesthetically they are
creepy.
Yes, they're creepy, which I didn't get from the other ones.
Right.
As much, if that makes sense.
I don't know if that's something that I've wanted from my tomb raiding, is I want it to be scarier or be frightened of entering the tombs. I like the fact that Rise of the Tomb Raider, Christian and I both loved. It was our show's game of the year it came out, like, 2 or 3 years ago. And we're big fans of that game, loved that game. And I love the fact that there were so many tombs in it that were optional, but they were sort of little puzzles and really cleverly designed and stuff. I don't know if I ever came out of them going, man, I wish there was more tension and fear in here.
Well, too bad.
Fair enough. If it's location specific. Like, you know, I think if it makes sense in the story in some way, I don't know if Mayan tombs are perhaps more terrifying or grotesque than others, but I hope there's a world justification for it. Brandon, what I'm super curious about though is what you played it on and how it looked and felt. Because after what went public was this very shiny trailer.
Right.
And in the day and age where everything is like gameplay footage, or even like the Naughty Dog stuff, it says like rendered on a PS4 or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. This very clearly said not actual gameplay. And I was like, that's interesting. And then reports came out that people got to play it. So they had gameplay available, right?
Yes. I think they just wanted their initial reveal trailer to be CG so they could cut that down for digital ads and all that jazz they like to do nowadays. But no, I played it on Xbox One dev kits. I assume on 4K TVs. I don't know why they would do that and not have it on 4K, but it was beautiful. Like, it was gorgeous. I actually just beat Rise a little while ago because I went through Uncharted 4. I was going through my backlog, essentially. I was like, I want to play Uncharted 4. I beat that, and I was like, all right, now it's time for Rise. And Rise is also beautiful on the Xbox One X. And this one, it looked amazing. It starts off more of like a slow walk through because it's like a Dia de los Muertos festival, and the lighting is really – again, everything is darker. Like, it's like moonlight, stuff like that, moonlight and rain, which is almost a little similar how to Uncharted 4 revealed itself with the moonlight tech or whatever that was. But it looked – yes, it looked absolutely gorgeous. And some of the mechanics I think are going to evolve the franchise in ways that I enjoy. Because honestly, my favorite part of those games is – jumping and climbing stuff, right?
Like, that's for sure.
Like,
yeah,
figuring that puzzle element out. So she has some new moves in her arsenal, which were apparent right off the bat, which was cool. So it's the same standard like climbing stuff, but now you can rappel off of, so anywhere you are, if you're just on a cliffside, you can rappel off of it and just go down and start hanging and then swing from that, you know, rappel. So I think that's going to have open up a lot of you know, elements of how you get around within gameplay structure. And
it's always been sort of like the Uncharted games where it's point to point. It's more about finding the correct route than anything else. Is it feel a little more free form than that now with that added ability or no?
I'd say yes, but I think what it does is kind of wrap back to what they wanted to do in general, which is, you know, heighten the gameplay and make it a little bit more scary. Cause now you're talking about when you gaze over a landscape of how you're supposed to get somewhere, there's huge gaps, like stuff that you wouldn't be able to do before. But now with the rappel, you're able to kind of do that and get by it. So
it's cool.
I think that's what they were going for. And it's something that sets it apart from Uncharted a little bit. But they're different games at this point, honestly.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree with that for sure. They feel like they have enough differentiators to make them definitely feel like unique franchises. And I'm glad about that. I'm super excited about this game. Like I said, love the last two. I'm super excited to see where the story goes. I feel like the story has been strong in these last two installments. The where you go and what you get to do has been super strong. Very, very excited. Mm-hmm. But I think Christian brings up a really strong point, which is for somebody that didn't go to the event, like myself, I was busy having a child. The way this was rolled out seems bizarre and a little unfortunate. I get the fact that we are in this place with video game marketing and PR now where there are these stages and we want to have the first thing be this kind of slick, you know, commercial like CG trailer, and then you have it builds you up the ability to say the next stage is a cool gameplay reveal and that. But if you're doing an event where people are playing it anyway, why even have the not actual gameplay trailer, especially when the not actual gameplay trailer didn't actually look better than the game? The game itself, I think, looks better than the CG trailer. And the CG trailer, honestly, again, I'm excited for this game. I love this franchise. But, man, that CG trailer was not strong for the ability to go and do anything because you're not tethered to actual gameplay footage. It really felt kind of uninteresting and pedestrian. I just don't get it. I don't get – I mean, I know they were plagued with some leaks that – messed up their scheduling a little bit, but just show us the game. I mean, they showed the people that went to the event. I don't understand this tactic.
Yeah. I don't know. It could have been a thing where their PR got messed up. Like originally, maybe this wasn't supposed to happen and they're supposed to do the reveal here and then have gameplay at a separate thing.
Yeah.
And then it kind of felt maybe a little bit like that, because honestly, the event was, you walked in, there was a real quick presentation basically about the pillars of the franchise and how they're evolving them, which I liked. Like, it was short, and then they were like, go and play the game. So it was interesting, but I can definitely see your point.
Anyhow, as you said, September 14th, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Windows PC. We will, I'm sure, get lots more details about the game as we get closer to it. But I'm definitely excited for this. This is going to be a big fall release and one I am eagerly anticipating. Yes. Christian, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I'm good. I also am excited about the game. I think it's an unfortunate release period for it, but I hope it manages to track well and people give it a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your story of the week then, Christian?
My story of the week this week is speaking at Reboot Develop last week, Mike Wilson, who is he is the co-founder of Devolver Digital and Good Shepherd. He was talking about the difficulties of indie development. And this stuff kind of comes up from time to time and you get different anecdotes about it. There was a talk at GDC about, and I forget the individual who gave the speech, I apologize, but it was, The thesis was kind of, you're not going to make money on your game. You know, all these games come out, most of them don't pay a livable wage, most of them don't pay minimum wage. You think about the hours, like think about what you're doing before you go out into it. And what Mike was saying is that, or the kind of the core of this speech was this idea that developers are obligated or expected to have a direct conversation with their audience and on a regular basis throughout development. And I think this kind of goes hand in hand with the conversation we just had about Tomb Raider and its reveal. Because I think even for larger games, that is a thing now, where, you know, whether it be Insomniac or 343 or Bungie, you know, people rake Bungie over the coals for not being direct enough or talking to people enough about the development or what changes they're doing. And Mike talked about that. For indie games, these are very small teams trying to do something very hard, you know, making a game and make a game that stands out, and how the gaming community, especially the vocal or on Twitter gaming community, can be full of some awful people, some trolls and some people that want to tell you how bad you're doing and why your game looks dumb. And he kind of was just talking about why indies are having such a hard time, where it's this mix of noise from fans, trolls, and then you're trying to work on this game, but also foster this community so that it can stand out, and just kind of the harsh realities of development today. And I think stories like this are important to give airtime to, one, to remind everyone that these are humans that make the games. Like when Corey had when he read reviews for God of War, I think that was a great moment for it. And two, I think to remind people how small some of these teams are that make some of your favorite games, be it Celeste or Shovel Knight or even Rocket League, you know, in comparison. Yeah. And even Ted Price.
Sunset Overdrive, right? Right, Brandon?
Yes. I mean, that's what I was going to say. That's what Ted talked about for Spider-Man, the last Game Informer video, was Ted's like, you know, we're a small team. Yeah. And yeah, Brandon, on Sunset, like, you guys were fostering a new community with an Xbox One exclusivity, also making this game, also listening to fan feedback. And because you're on the show, Brandon, and you can, whatever you can say publicly to speak to it generally, I'm curious what your take on this was when you were in active development and kind of how you've seen it change since.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's almost the, if you look at kind of the evolution of, because I think it's honestly a community management like thing. At its core, it's almost very similar to community management and how you manage it. And then it's like we went through this time where there was no community management. We just released games. Great. And then it was like, oh, let's foster community with really multiplayer games, I think is what made community management a thing. And social media as well, obviously. And then it was like, okay, now social media people are community managers are essentially, I felt like a fire guard. Because when I started at Insomniac, I was a community manager. And those, I was like during the Fuse days. And like, I actually enjoy Fuse, but a lot of people didn't enjoy Fuse for multiple reasons. And at that time, you're just basically trying to not necessarily fight a community, but you're trying to explain to them why they might enjoy it or why it might not be for them, even if it's kind of against what you have been in the past. So that was interesting. And I think that's a unique thing that faces AAA developers. But now with indie developers, it's kind of like, I think honestly, early access games are kind of the ones that get boned by this the most. Because if you think about it, like at game studios, you have milestones and you have roadmaps and all that kind of stuff. So it's literally like when you're making a game, it's like, okay, here's what we need to do to make it. All right, this month we'll have this done. It's like anything else. You know what I mean? But then essentially early access titles take away that last part of development, which is honestly the hardest part, because you build the core of the game and then you release it. And then you're still trying to put all the pieces together, but it's out there in the open and everyone has an opinion on what they want from it. Yeah. So I think a lot of these early access games, what they don't do successfully is tell people exactly what their roadmap is. So that way,
the early in early access is a huge spectrum, right? And it's one heading under which a game can be a variety of games can be at a whole bunch of different states of being finished, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think just like if you don't give a direct roadmap and say these are the pillars or these are the main features that are going to come and drop, then you're going to have your whole community asking for features and basically all of a sudden designing a different game than what you have. Like you can make small changes. You can respond to a community on small changes, like stuff that's going to be number changes in the code or something like that. Or if they really want, you know, obviously there can be bigger things as well, but sometimes honestly, people just want a different game than what you have made. And I think a lot of indie developers, if they're making something and people want something different, then it just gets jumbled, right? It's almost like too many cooks, except the cooks are people online who don't actually know how to cook, even though they have the best intentions. You know what I mean?
That's the biggest part that I took away from this speech by Mike Wilson is he's basically saying it's Dunning-Kruger, right? It's a bunch of people who have no knowledge of the topic from the inside thinking they have an expert level knowledge of the topic and applying a bias to the people making the game based on information that is just flat out wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're, you know, it's like it's a strange thing that video games somehow, I guess because just the nature of it being a hobby for young people that feels, you know, it started out with a couple people in their garage making stuff and has become, you know, these massive teams and huge budgets. I guess people somewhere along the way lost the thread of how things are made because, you wouldn't have somebody with a new car going like, oh, this is dumb. The wheels should be like 6 inches farther back. It's like, well, in order to do that, you would have to redesign the entire chassis of we'd have to go back and, you know, it's the equivalent of that, of you don't understand what it would take to move the wheels in the car 6 inches either side. You know, nobody says it like that about anything other than video games, but for some reason, video games feel like, hey, why did you just do this? Or well, people, go ahead.
It's not understanding. And Bungie, I think, had one interesting podcast about it when they had their community feedback. It's people not understanding the differences that are required to make changes. And part of that is because, yeah, they've never cooked before. And the industry also, I think, you know, not to put blame on the industry, but it's not very clear what is required to make these things. So it's one like, oh, this gun is OP, and then they're able to fix it overnight. But then it's like, oh, my jump is too floaty. And they're like, we can't fix that. And I think to the layperson, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And maybe in a different game that's reversed and the jump mechanic is easy to change. But because of the code that this game is based on to implement this change in how a sparrow is done, is can't be done in this game. And it seems like it should be an easy fix. So you have these people that it doesn't make sense why one thing can be changed and why one thing can't be changed. And then added to that, though, developers or publishers or community managers trying to engage a community are actively asking for feedback, but they're not asking for AB style feedback. It's like, it's kind of a floodgate is opened, but they can't do half the things that are suggested. But you want to have this dialogue of like, all right, this game's out in early access. We want your help. And like, that's always the Kickstarter video or the pitch video is like, you're going to have a say. We want you to contribute. And then people are like, all right, game on, knuckle crack, type, 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 type. Here's everything I want fixed. And then we just meant, do you want your car to be red or blue? Like we can't do all that. So I think there's issues. It's a complex issue. And I don't know if it'll ever be ironed out because neither side is as clear as they could be, if that makes sense.
It was an interesting discussion. I mean, an interesting talk at this event. He also talked about how, you know, these crunch weeks and the sort of working conditions that game developers just routinely have to deal with. And nobody seems to bat an eye that people work 7 days a week and 90 hours and don't see their families for a month at a time before the game comes out. And it's just the way it is. So, you know, hopefully at some point all of this stuff gets a little less insane. And, you know, we remember that human beings make these things and we treat them like human beings. You know, I remain optimistic that we can all regain our humanity somehow in this crazy world we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. The crunch thing is reared its head again, I think, because of, did y'all talk about the 90 hour week comment that one dev made?
Yeah. I mean, you're welcome to comment on it. You certainly have more information about that than we would.
Yeah. I mean, obviously crunch is a thing, and it's because we just have accelerating expectations, but we don't have necessarily accelerating tech right now.
Yeah.
It's still getting better. Obviously it's getting easier to do things, but the level of detail that's kind of required, is just kind of astronomical right now. If you look at something like everyone, you know, cause everyone's like, we want an Uncharted 4 level AAA game. And it's like, okay, well, they had like 500 people across a few different studios doing it.
Right.
Did y'all read the EA report about the Star Wars game?
Yes.
I think that was a very realistic look. And a lot of developers, I think, have now been able to manage it properly, but I just think it's almost the thing you expect, which is not necessarily great, but I think it's something that it's like, okay, that's going to be crunch at this time. Hopefully we have done our milestones properly and it won't be too bad, but probably in order to ship this thing, that's what will happen. Like that's where I think the hidden roadmap is interesting. That's why I think AAA games get a little bit of a lighter benefit because they're not early access, because it's like internally they have stuff that they're cutting like crazy.
Yeah.
Like as it gets close, they're like, okay, well, we're not going to do that, so let's cut it. It's not going to be able to release. Like, because you think a lot of these AAA games have
to be. You mean like a single player campaign for Call of Duty?
yeah, exactly.
You know, just throw 100 people on a map and let them go at it.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Seems to work.
Yeah, but like, if you think about these AAA games, realistically, a lot of them have to be finished, like content complete is what it's called, like 2 or 3 months before the actual release, because then those rest of the times it's going through certification and it's trying to, you know, iron out the very critical bugs.
Right.
So it's not like, I don't know, it's tough. It's tough. And I know like dev cycles are getting longer, but I mean, look at God of War. God of War was amazing, but God of War also took like 5-6 years to make.
Yeah. I actually on Twitter this week, somebody at replied me and said, oh my God, I love God of War. How come every game can't be like this? And I wrote back, he said something like, somebody in the industry needs to give me a reason why every game can't look and feel like this. And I wrote back, here's two: time, money.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, it's the fact that Sony Santa Monica was able to work on that game for 5 years. And
even that game, Corey talked about the crunch, and talked about it as he's like, yeah, it's a real thing, but we never asked anyone to stay late. It's just because people are passionate about it. And there's a whole other conversation about like asked versus expected. Well,
Mike Wilson talks about that in his reboot thing. He was like, he's saying it's a culture of like, bro, you know, even if nobody's asking you to work 90 hours, it's like, well, we're all staying. Are you staying? You know, it's that kind of thing too.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of problems, but I think this dovetails nicely into the next topic that I wanted to bring up for story of the week, which, because I think a seed of a solution to this, maybe not a complete solution, but something that may help in the long run, I hope, is to do something more along the lines of what Bethesda seems to be doing, which is we're not talking about the game until it's very close to being done. We're just not even going to talk about it. We're not going to have a conversation with the audience. We're not going to even announce it. We're not going to tell you what we're working on until it's very close to being done. I think that may actually help. And, you know, we're coming up to an E3 very soon. I'm getting invites and all kinds of crazy stuff already. And we, you know, Bethesda has their annual press conference. I have no idea anything that Bethesda is going to be. I mean, there's rumors of this, this space RPG game. I'm very hopeful that's
Anthem.
True.
Anthem. It's called Anthem.
No, I think it's called Star something.
Oh, no. It's
Star Citizen.
Star Citizen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the fact of the matter is, you know, they're just not talking about stuff until it comes out. And we also found out this week that Nintendo, who sits out E3 officially, but also has a big Nintendo Direct presentation in the slot where their, you know, their press conference would have been, is going to be pretty much exclusively talking about Smash Brothers on Switch. And last year that worked out pretty well for them, having one game that they focused on. That strategy was Super Mario Odyssey, and that game, you know, was a huge hit, great game. And it was pretty much the only thing they talked about. Of course, they talked about some other third party stuff, some DS stuff. You know, they fill out the discussion rather well. And there's a Yoshi game we know about. There's a Fire Emblem game we know about. Probably will be talked about. But for all intents and purposes, it's a single game E3 strategy that Nintendo is employing. This year, that game is Super Smash Brothers, which we know about, has just been announced. Brendan, I'm curious. Is this a good thing? Is this enough? Is a Smash Brothers game? It's one thing to have a Mario game that is completely new and different kind of Mario game to focus on, and it's sort of the coming out party for what this game even is. But we kind of know what a Smash Brothers game is. Is that going to be enough for Nintendo?
I think so. This is probably me being biased, but I love Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm. It's the reason I will get a Switch officially. Because it's what they're able to do with Smash Brothers is almost they've done so good so far. They were able to do it with Breath of the Wild, boom, hit it, knocked it out of the park. Boom. A new, you know, Mario Brothers, great, knock it out of the park. And now this kind of caters to more of that. It's weird because you think Nintendo, whatever they do at E3 is they always cater specifically to the hardcore because they know that's exactly their audience. But every other marketing for Nintendo is very focused on family stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like really they go hard at E3 and then the rest of the year they know they're like Nintendo Labo. Like they promote Nintendo Labo like crazy. Like I don't think people understand how much Nintendo markets. It's just it doesn't market to you or me anymore. Like it's always at like a lower like families and stuff like that, or, mm-hmm. you know, younger kids. So I think it's enough. I think it's what they have to do here because I think the rest of their – otherwise their lineup is, I won't say weak, but it's less than what it has been as far as, like, big giant titles. So new Smash Brothers, as long as it is a new one and not a kind of remaster with some changes a la, you know, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, then I do think it's enough. I think it's enough. Remember they did this a couple years ago with Smash 4. Where it was just, that's the first time they were like, we're only going to have basically one game right on our show floor and everyone's going to play it. So I think it's enough.
All right. Well, Christian, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with 100%. It needs to be a new game and they need to show enough characters. They can't just show like, and here's, like we said, the Inklings are in it and that's it. They need to give a sizable chunk and have a decent number of characters to play. And that will do very well for Nintendo in terms of dominating press coverage and getting their hardcore very excited. And then tournaments, getting hands on with that, maybe a GameCube controller adapter again or something like that. There's a lot of stuff they can do around this game that will get people very excited. Maybe they'll even officially announce an actual sanctioned tournament or some form of, you know, they advertised the Switch way back when as being this eSport device. They were doing it with Splatoon 2. But imagine if Nintendo actually put their weight behind the eSport of Smash. I think there's a lot they could do here with this game that would be huge at E3.
Well, you guys are certainly bigger Smash fans than I am, so I'll defer to your opinions on this one. It feels a little bit disappointing. Maybe there'll be some surprises. Maybe we'll get a glimpse of that Metroid that is still probably 2 years away. Maybe there'll be things I don't expect, but it certainly seems like Nintendo is laying their cards out on the table. And as they have done in previous years, when they do this, it tends to be they weren't lying. there was no big reveal. It really was all Super Mario Odyssey. You know, their entire booth looked like New Donk City. It was, so I expect more of that. And it's has worked for them. So, you know, if it ain't broke, I guess.
Oh man. I just want their booth that they're like ran. Someone's on the top on scaffolding, just like dropping prizes in randomly. Oh, it's time for you to leave their booth. They just shove you out really hard.
I still think the best marketing they could do for this game, honestly, if the entire booth for them was in the middle, it was an arena, like a boxing arena, like a wrestling, and they just had mascot characters going at it, and there was just, you know, commenting
just Fight
on
Club.
It. Yes, that'd be amazing.
That's someone who's played a mascotted character or a person in costume at E3 before, Brandon. Is this something that you'd want to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would, if I didn't have to talk, like honestly, the talking was the thing that killed me most. I don't see how you can do more damage
talking
to my
is worse
body
than fighting. You'd rather have somebody punch you in the face than talk.
I think my throat was real sore. It was real sore.
All right, guys, let's move on to talking about the games we have been playing. But first, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This, I love talking about Blue Apron because, as you guys know, if you've listened to the show before, I really believe that Blue Apron has changed my life for the better. I love living in a world where Blue Apron exists. I recommend it to everybody. Anytime I go to a party, I ask people, do you guys know about Blue Apron?
Every doctor that came in while Jeff's second child was being born, it was like, oh, thanks, doc. Quick question, though.
Quick question about the Blue Apron. No, honestly, though, you joke, but I was just having this conversation the other day about I've just had my second child this week, and I was saying how much I love the fact that, honestly, because of Blue Apron, my kids are going to grow up in a household where we, like, prepare food together. And I cook for the family, and mealtime is sacrosanct, and you know, we see the food that we're going to eat and we know what goes into it because I make it. And I wouldn't have happened. I wasn't that guy before Blue Apron because I didn't want to deal with the hassle of figuring out what to make, going to the store, buying the ingredients, having too many of the ingredients when I'm done making the thing and then it just goes bad in the fridge. All of those hassles Blue Apron has completely eliminated because they give you just the amount of ingredients you need. They have delicious meals, delicious recipes that you can choose from to build out your menu every week. And almost never repeats. It's always there's a huge variety of delicious meals. Let me read you what I made this week. Shrimp and tomato spaghettini with garlic oregano breadcrumbs. Absolutely delicious. You know, shrimp pasta. It was so good. You can make it in a very short amount of time. I've become skilled at like chopping things. I enjoy it. It really has changed my life for the better. And there's a new promotion for 6 weeks from April 16th through May 21st. Blue Apron is teaming with Airbnb to bring you the best home cooking from around the world. Each week, the Blue Apron menu will feature a recipe developed in collaboration with an Airbnb experience host like Cece, a chef from Shanghai who makes incredible Kung Pao chicken, a beloved sticky sauce mix of crispy browned chicken and vegetables. It is it's a really cool thing that they're doing, and this is an example of how much the variety improves my life. Because even when I was single or when I was dating, even when I made something myself, which wasn't very often, it would be like the same four things over and over and over because I knew how to make those things. I could make, I had the salmon that I could make. So like anytime I wanted to impress a girl, I made the salmon. But then I made that once and it's like, well, now I got to make the salmon again because that's all I know how to make. With Blue Apron, It's a new recipe. The recipes are always really delicious and really they're healthy because you know what's going into them. All the ingredients are fresh. You only get exactly what you need. There's convenience. There's flexibility because there's 12 new recipes every week, and you can pick 2, 3, or 4 of them based on what you need for your schedule. Non-GMO ingredients, meat with no added hormones. It's great. I honestly love it. And guess what? We're going to give you 3 meals free if you go to blueapron.com/DLC. That's blueapron.com/DLC. You'll get 3 meals free on us to check it out, see how it can change your life like it has changed mine. Boy, I love it. So give them a shot. blueapron.com/DLC. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Brandon, let's start talking about what is on your playlist. What have you been playing lately?
Sweet. Yes, I'm actually very disappointed in myself because I have not been able to catch up with all the newness like Far Cry 5, God of War. I have not played yet. I've passively watched my roommate play God of War. Seems fantastic. I'm excited to play eventually. But
are you just like waiting for your roommate to finish so you can be like, okay, my turn?
Absolutely. Yes. He uses my Xbox enough that I can just take that.
But you've got spoilers happening right in front of you. Or you just don't care about that?
Well, he's usually playing like arenas and stuff when I go in. Okay. Like it's fine. All and right. Someone's shouting boy. I've seen all the memes, so I feel like I pretty much know the gist. But I haven't seen any of the crazy boss fights, so that's what I'm excited to kind of experience.
Cool.
But I did – the other night I started Assassin's Creed Origins just because I was like, yeah, let's do this. I haven't played an Assassin's Creed game since, Revelations, so I'm like finally ready for one.
It sounds like you're not thinking your roommate's going to be done anytime soon if you're starting a, you know, 60-hour yeah. experience.
That's fair. I expect it'll take me a while to get through Origins. But yeah, I just started. I played like 2 hours of it and really just had – I just had fun running around. It's beautiful. I was kind of surprised at how gorgeous it looked. And yeah, it was good. I hadn't played a God of War – or not God of War. I hadn't played Assassin's Creed game in a long time, and it feels good. And the combat's way different. It takes a little bit more thought instead of just what it was before, so that was really enjoyable. I like the new setting.
About God of War or Assassin's Creed?
No, Assassin's Creed. Same note. Can you ride a camel?
I don't want to spoil anything about God of War.
Okay, thank you.
Very big in Norse mythology is that camel riding stuff.
It's true. It's true. That's why, you know, yeah. I also, I hadn't played HOTS in Heroes of the Storm in a very long time. And I actually started playing it this week a little bit again.
We talk about Heroes of the Storm?
Yeah, well, so I've been super out of – ever since Overwatch came out, I kind of tempered my Heroes of the Storm addiction.
Right.
What brought you back?
I think I'm going to go to Heroes of the Dorm. And I was like, I should brush up on some knowledge. I'm so bad at it. I forgot that you lose your MOBA fingers so quickly. But it's fun. I enjoy the brawls. Like I hadn't played with all the new Overwatch heroes, like Junkrat and everything like that. So yeah. It was, I think Tracer was added like right when Overwatch came out. So I played her a little bit, but yeah, Heroes of the Storm still consistently fun. I still love that I can get, you know, a satisfying match in 20 minutes. Whereas, because I came from the League of Legends world where it was like
an hour
and I would lose and, you know, that wasn't great.
Have you tried Deckard Cain yet? He just came in this week.
No, I haven't. Is he fun?
He's real fun. Yeah, yeah. He was the big PAX East announcement. And, you know, he's from Diablo. He's the old man who says, stay a while and listen. He's, you know, kind of a comedic narrator character. So putting him into this crazy brawling game is a bit wacky, and I love that. I love how wacky it is, but it's cool. Yeah. He throws out Diablo potions on the ground and your team can pick them up. So you're literally like getting Diablo potions strewn about the battlefield, and he has the heraldic cube that he can use. It's really cool. Yeah.
It's just fun. It's a fun MOBA, and I want to keep it in rotation just because it is very enjoyable to play. So hopefully I do go to Heroes of the Dorm so I can see what that's about like.
I have been to 2 out of the 3 Heroes of the Dorms, and it is a fantastic event. I loved going to Heroes of the Dorm. I think it's back in LA this year, right?
Yeah, it's at the Overwatch Arena. So.
Oh, rad. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. But yeah, other than that, also, I should talk about, have you guys played Slay the Spire?
I love that. I haven't played the new third hero yet, though.
Yes, yes. So Slay the Spire is also something that I kind of always go back to for the new updates. And that, and actually, if you don't know what it is for the listeners, it's like a deck building card game with roguelike elements. So it's like Dominion mixed with Binding of Isaac. So it's like two of these worlds that I love combined. And it's a lot of fun. And I honestly think it, what we talked about earlier about indie devs having a hard time kind of managing their community. If you look at what he's able to do with his stuff, it's, he does it perfectly. Cause he gave a roadmap. He was like, we're going to have a third character by summer. And then by like midsummer, that's when I want to release the game officially. And he, I think it's a little bit easier on him because he's tweaking card balances and stuff if people are in uproar about something. But still, he gives feedback to the community. You know exactly when it's going to update every week. And he's trained people. He'll tell people it's not going to be a large update at, like, as soon as the last one comes out and stuff like that. And anyways, really enjoyable experience, especially because you can play it passively. So you can like watch TV and just, you know, play the dungeon run. So
yeah, I got to get back into it. I got so hooked on that game and then played out basically the content that was in it up to that point. And now that this third hero, everybody says the third hero is like really plays a lot differently than the first two, which is really exciting.
Yeah. He has like orb things, like it's like orbs you utilize. So it's completely different than the main two because they're a little similar, but this one's definitely the most different. So,
so excited. It's a great game. It really is. Yeah. So well designed. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Christian, how about you? What's on your playlist?
So I'm still playing God of War, still not super, super far in it because I was in Memphis for the past few days. I really thought about bringing my PlayStation and like skipping some of the social events, being like, okay, I'm here to do some charity work. And then after that, I'll just sit in my room and play God of War.
You gotta go to that, Bass Pro Shop.
Yeah, I wasn't going to be able to eat on the swamp inside a pyramid next to downtown Memphis ever again. So that was my one shot.
You're squarely in, you know, you're teasing the spoilers, man. You're like, you're in the danger zone where they're just spoilers are flying. And no, I'm not saying, I'm saying you are poking the tiger. The world is full of spoilers now. And the fact that you are you're kind of taking your time with it, I feel it's rife with peril.
I'm not going to play a game at a pace in which I do not want to play it because the internet is full of jerks.
Really?
You know, like I'm not going to.
That's how people watch Netflix shows. People binge Netflix shows specifically because
they know that
everybody's going to be a jerk.
Remember my social media position, Jeff? It's so good. You should try it. Mm. it's real good. No, I understand that, but that whole be done with it first, not to do the bit, but I have a line in a longer joke where I hypothesize that in a year Netflix will have an option just to click saying you've watched a thing, so you don't even need to watch it anymore to be first. You can just be like House of Cards season 7, watched it. That's all people care about.
It'll be charged that extra. Yeah. DL, yeah. That's microtransaction. Yeah.
But I'm still very much enjoying it. It felt weird to take it and, you know, not engage with the people that I was there to engage with. But what I did bring, because I was traveling and I had layovers in hotel, at airports and some late night hotel time, and it's much easier to travel with me. This baby boy jumped back into Breath of the Wild, Jeff.
What?
Uh-huh. I have not killed Ganon yet, but I'm slowly making progress and actually a little faster now because I've decided when I'm jumping back in, I'm going to use Ye Old Guide to help me. So my rule is if I feel frustrated within 15 minutes of attempting to do, like actively trying to do something, I will access the guide. And so far, so good. I oftentimes, you know, I talk about how I like playing games on easy often, but I tend to be one of those people that avoids guides and it's like, I'm going to figure this out. But when it's a game that I've shelved for so long that I had a lot of enjoyment with, but you know, put away and didn't see myself getting back into, I was like, you know what? I should use a guide. Like, what is my stigma for using a guide? Would I rather see this content or play it and have fun with it with the help of a guide than not at all? And I might become a guide guy. Are either of you guide guys?
No way. I hate being a guide guy. I've always been very anti-guide guy.
Brandon?
Yeah, I not generally. The only times I will use them is if if like I, which I gosh, and this wasn't even back in the day because now I don't really care about collecting things. But if a game has a lot of collectibles and I, my OCD is firing off and I need them all and it doesn't give me like a look, you know, location map on natively in the game, then I will definitely go for a guide. But other than that, I generally avoid guides.
And I think that's how I am for games on my current log. But I'm wondering now for these backlog games, when I have time to approach them again, and clearly I haven't made time for them yet, that maybe, you know, using a guide with some rules in place for when I access it. So for Zelda, if I'm in a shrine, I won't use the guide for the shrine. Like, that's a puzzle. I don't need to get it. That doesn't hamper my progress of the game per se. But if I'm on a Divine Beast and I spend 15 minutes on one aspect of a puzzle and I can't figure it out, and I'm at the point where I'm going to put the game down, I'm going to look. And I did that over these past couple of days. And that game is, it holds up so well still. Like, how, you know, it's only, I guess, what, 2 years old now or whatever it is. But I think that is the game, Jeff, that you talk about how Shadow of the Colossus is such a rare game that it can be remastered and feel fresh. I have a feeling Breath of the Wild might be that as well.
Interesting.
While a lot of games will learn from it and incorporate aspects of it, I don't know if anyone else will do it in such a pure and clean way. Even Nintendo, again, with their next Zelda game, I don't know if they'll be able to recreate the magic that game has.
I'll one-up you. I would bet that it doesn't, it's so sort of, universal that, and the art direction is so strong that it won't even really ever need a remaster. It's an animated aesthetic that I think will never feel so dated that it will seem like a limitation of technology. I think it will.
Kind of like Okami?
Yeah, Okami four remasters later. Yeah. I mean,
but I think it's that kind of approach, though. And I think the same was true of Wind Waker. Like, when that came out, it got a lot of crap for its art style. But yes, the HD version looks good, but you can play that straight from disc today, and it still holds up way better than so much of what else was released in its era.
You ready for me to give you a bold prediction? A bold and, what was it?
I mean, suddenly
Cool Ranch?
I feel like it's 2019 already, but yes, I'm ready.
Cool Ranch prediction?
Sure.
The Zelda, this is a far, far future prediction. The Breath of the Wild remaster will be when it gets remastered into VR. Because that will be the technology where everything will feel old if you just look at stuff on a 2D plane.
That'll be its first remaster, or there will be a remaster?
I think
of that
will be, you'll see games like that remastered to catch up to that technology, because that's the technology that will make games with universal art direction type situations feel outdated. Because why am I staring at this big 3D world on a 2D plane when I can be inside it?
Well, I think Skyrim proves that these big RPGs can be great in VR. I don't think it's too far-fetched to think Breath of the Wild gets a VR.
I'm not saying next year, 2 years,
no, right,
5 years.
Right.
I'm saying like in the same way that Shadow of the Colossus, like 15 years later or 10, whenever it was, 10 years later. I'm saying that's when you look back on Breath of the Wild and you're like, oh man, wouldn't it be great to play it on today's technology? Today's technology is going to be fully immersive. You're inside it.
I think you'll get a remaster of Breath of the Wild well before that, though. I think Brandon would agree with me there, but I don't want to put words in his mouth.
It depends on when my voice cracks. So right now. I think it depends on when Nintendo goes 4K, because I absolutely think they're going to be like 4K version. Poo, like,
interesting.
You know.
I don't think anybody cares about needing to be in 4K, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, Apple's working on an 8K headset, according to Macro.
Dude, man. Gimme.
Just can't keep up. Gimme.
And then the last thing for this week, when I got home, my daughter wanted to go fishing. So we did a bunch of Labo fishing, and she caught her first run of three in that. If the fishing game, it gives you like a score and a weight after you catch three successive fisheye, I think is the plural of fishes.
yeah, that's why the lens always, it's because it has multiple fishes in it, a fisheye lens. Yeah.
<That's right. laughs> Well done, Double Dad. But she caught her first three on her own, and you have to kind of do this kind of jerk with the rod before you reel in the bigger the fish. You have to kind of finesse it a little bit more. She did that. It's real fun. She's still like, she's five. So she's, and she's a smart kid.
Is it fun because it's fun, or is it fun because you built the thing?
Both. I would love if that fishing, I mean, buying the peripheral would be annoying, but it's a cool fishing mini game. Like, I'm not going to play it for 20 hours, but it's a cool fishing mini game. And the way the string, like, you're on a real string that's tethered and has pull. And then the way it goes into the screen and reacts accurately, and like the HD rumble and the Joy-Cons. Like, I was going to say, my daughter's five. She's a smart kid, but she's still like, occasionally I feel like I catch her like kind of peeking behind to see where the string go. Like, is the string really going into the screen? Like, the fidelity and the accuracy of it is really cool. Awesome. Maybe I'll bring it in this week.
I would love to see it, dude. I've been tempted to buy one. I just isn't conducive with my life right now, but yeah.
I can only bring one thing in at a time because they are not small. Like, it's a sizable contraption.
Huge.
Yeah. Like, I don't have it, but a friend sent me a picture. I mean, it's a backpack.
Yeah.
Like, a real like middle schooler sized backpack.
Amazing.
Yeah.
My playlist this week is a little abbreviated. As I said, I had a child. But I'm still cranking on Frostpunk, which I talked about last week. I still think is amazing, but also very depressing.
It sold very well too. So yeah. That's another indie dev doing big things.
Yeah. And I think another dev that communicated with their audience very, very well. But I want to tell you about a game called For the King. And Brandon, if you like Slay the Spire, you may like this. Do you know about this game already?
I think I've passively heard of it, but I haven't looked into it.
It's been in early access for a while. I didn't play it in early access, but it came out of early access into full release just, the 19th, April 19th it came out. Oh, so,
it looks really good.
Yeah. They call it a roguelike tabletop adventure. So, I mean, there's no more like Jeff buy this immediately advertising than that. So I plunked down, it's 20% off right now, $15. I bought it. And it got its hooks into me pretty good. It's got a really interesting aesthetic. The graphics very much look like papercraft. It's kind of got an angular look, really sharp, I think. Not super detailed, but I like that. Look, it grew on me very, very quickly. And you are playing very similar to a dungeon crawling tabletop game, a hexagonal big world where things are covered over by fog of war. So you don't see everything on the map at first, but you control three characters. And it's kind of odd because it's really built like a board game in the sense that it assumes each of these three characters is autonomous. It's built for co-op. You can play it in co-op and have each character played by an individual. But you can also play it as a solo game, which I did. But even in playing it as a solo game, you're not moving your party around like a party. You're moving each individual pawn on the board at once.
Interesting.
Which is actually a little tedious. It's actually my biggest complaint about the game is if I haven't found a situation where I want my group to split up because that means almost certain death. So I've wanted everybody to be in the fights as a group. So moving around the map means like, okay, I'm going to move this person, but I don't want them to move too far away because I don't want them to get into a fight by themselves. So they move a few spaces, then the next everybody moves up, and then, you know, it's sort of that that rubber banding thing where you're like, oh, this moves forward and then everybody catches up. And then this guy moves forward and then everybody catches up.
The thing you put in the cardboard you just built, like that rubber banding?
Yeah, Lavo style. So that's really my biggest complaint so far. Also, it is a brutal game. It is a roguelike. And that's another conversation I want to have at the end of this, so remind me. But it's got some really cool, interesting mechanisms in it. The combat is turn-based. I love turn-based combat. You get into these fights, you get into a much closer view, you know, like a Japanese-style role-playing game would, and you control your guys, and everything is based on dice rolls of 100-sided dice, and based on your stats, the gear you're wearing and your base, you know, strength and intelligence and all the stats, that affects, it has modifiers on your dice rolls. And based on the weapon you're wielding, it uses a different stat for the dice modifier. But it rolls multiple dice for anything you want to do, and there's successes and failures on each die roll. So one of the stats on all your items is how many dice rolls you get which I find to be a really interesting thing. And you also have this resource, which I believe is called Focus. I think it's called Focus. And that is like an automatic success, but you only regenerate your focus if you rest. So they're very precious. So you can go into any dice roll and just use up a focus on your character to get an automatic success and ensure that you're going to hit them or you're going to escape or whatever you want to do. But there's a finite amount of being able to do that. And there's multiple rolls within each test. You know, it's pretty clever and pretty fun. You get loot, you go down into these dungeons, which are very roguelike in the sense that you're going deeper and deeper and deeper. You're not able to come back out until you finish that dungeon. But then the sort of broader overworld where there's roaming monsters and you can attack them at any point. And you go and you get quests and you get better stuff, you know, your basic role-playing game. But very much feels like a tabletop game. I dig it. It's called For the King. And I'm really, really liking it.
Have you played any co-op?
I have not. I have not. I think it would probably be way better as a co-op game because it would feel like a dungeon crawling tabletop experience.
How long is a session typically? I know like roguelike that can mean like a minute or two, but like does it have a stopping point, so to speak, or like a
no,
in-game?
No, you save and continue. You go until you die. That's this kind of roguelike is how long can you go until you die? And that's really my biggest gripe. I know I've been on this show many, many, many times talking about how I love roguelikes when they're done right. And I do, but I kind of feel like not everything needs to be a roguelike. And I don't think this game needs it. I kind of don't understand. I understand the tension that you get of if you die, you lose all your stuff. And the game begins with this text box that says, you know, in very fantasy language, it says, you know, many adventurers have tried and they all fail. So don't be sad if you fail. It's all about the process, whatever. So it's telling you like it's about doing it over and over. But this game doesn't feel like that. You know, it's not like Children of Morta or Rogue Legacy or a lot of these or even Slay the Spire, which is like, oh, how far did I get this time? Oh, how far did I get this time? This one feels like I'm playing this big campaign. I don't want to have to start over. I want to save and keep going, and I want to be able to save, and if I die, revert back to that save. Like, that's the way this game feels, and I don't think it being a roguelike and me having to start over from the beginning because my entire team got wiped out. The other thing about this game that is frustrating is you can revive a downed character, but you only get a finite amount of those. So you start with four revives. So I've already used three of my four revives, and I'm like, well, I mean, come on. It's just a ticking clock for me to lose instead of this fun adventure that I'm having that I see no reason to limit me in that way and no reason to punish me in that way. It doesn't need to be a roguelike. It can just be this really cool tabletop-style adventure game with saves. It just isn't.
Right. That's interesting. I feel like having not played this game, obviously, it seems like that's kind of a core design principle for them was this idea of it being a roguelike. And it almost seems like listening to you say that they've built too fun of a game. Play it.
It doesn't, I feel like another way of saying that is that they didn't need the tension, right? Like Slay the Spire relies on that push your luck feeling, you know, how far can I get based on my resources, you know, like how do I managing the resources is really fun. But For the King, ultimately what it does is it makes me play like a real timid person where I go out and I fight something and then I go back to the town and I pay for the healer to heal my team. Then I go out and fight something and I go back to the healer and heal my team. Because you can go to the town and heal your team as long as you have gold, and you get gold every time you win a fight. So it's like, I'm just going to play in a way that's tedious and shouldn't be how I should approach this game. And it doesn't make it better. It doesn't, that tension isn't necessary. That push your luck aspect for this game doesn't feel like it's additive. It feels like it's taking away from this grand epic adventure feel, you know?
That's interesting.
But a game I can really, really honestly, recommend, especially at $15. I mean, I think it's a really cool game. I've heard that the difficulty spikes pretty hardcore, you know, coming up. I've only played, I don't know, 4 hours of this thing. So I'm still in the early maps where, but I, you know, I beat a few dungeons. It feels really fun. I've gotten some really cool items that made me feel super OP for a while. And, you know, it's really fun. I'm just worried that the difficulty is going to spike. My team is going to wipe and then I'm going to be like, eh, screw this game. So, For the King, again, is what that is called. All right. So let us move on now and talk about some other stuff. But I want to thank our second sponsor, which is Untuck It. Maybe you heard about me talk about Untuck It last week. Christian and I both got Untuck It shirts. Untuck
It. We're going to have a wear to work day, right?
Yeah, our Untuck It day. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always untucking it. I don't like tucking in my dress shirts. I like that look of being untucked. But unfortunately, a lot of untucked shirts don't look great when they're untucked. They're
like
too long.
Jerseys. It's like, yeah. That's not how that's supposed to be.
Yeah. It looks sloppy or even worse is I don't really want to tuck my shirt in. So the cool thing about Untuck It is that they're designed to be untucked. They're the right length where tucking it in doesn't work because they're just, you know, it doesn't go deep enough, but leaving it untucked, like, looks super sharp and they're clean and it hangs just below the belt line, which is what you want. It's really cool. It's a casual shirt, but it also feels a little nicer than, you know, your average dress shirt. It's really cool. They say it's a go-to for any occasion from casual to dressy. And I would concur. I really dig, my Untuck It. And they actually have, Untuck It's for girls as well, for females. So you should check that out. They're casual, versatile, and designed to last as well. So if you're a woman listening to the show, there are Untuck It's for you as well. You should check this out. We are going to give you 20% off your entire purchase if you use our promo code DLC at checkout at untuckit.com. So check these shirts out. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. I certainly was. I really like that look of, you know, I roll up my sleeves. I leave my shirt untucked. I even do that with shorts. Like, I like wearing a pair of shorts and a button-up shirt rolled up, the sleeves untucked.
I thought you were going to say you roll up your shorts and leave the pants untucked. And I was like, wait, where is this going?
No. I mean, the untucked button-up dress shirt with rolled up sleeves with shorts. Like, I think that's a great look. And then even flip-flops, you know, if you look nice. Untuck It, perfect for that. So check it out. Untuckit.com. Promo code DLC to get you 20% off your entire purchase. And you can also visit one of Untuck It's over 25 retail locations across the country. So stop hiding your shirt with your pants and your pants with your shirt. I love that promo.
Right now.
Brandon, you are a tabletop gamer. We just had International Tabletop Day. Yep. Felt like it was a good time to talk about some board games. What have you been bringing to your table?
Sure, yeah. It's so last night, actually, I had never played Cosmic Encounters, and I know in relative terms, it came out, 2008? So it's theoretically old in the landscape of board games nowadays.
I think it's much older than that.
Oh, really?
I think Cosmic Encounters, I think it's a very old game. Let me look it up.
Cosmically, 2008. Cosmically,
though. but go ahead. Tell me your experience.
1977. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
That's almost 2008.
Yeah. Jeez. I really enjoyed it. I love that. So it honestly takes kind of. It's I tier games because we have over 80 board games at my house.
Nice.
So we kind of think of them in our head as like party game and then not party game. So it's like, oh, we can play Secret Hitler, or we can play Dark Souls. Like, okay, well, it's a party, so let's not bust out Dark Souls. But we'll go with that. And I think this actually sits right in the middle because there's bluffing involved. It's you can play passively or actively, almost like a Splendor-esque type thing. It still gets you to communicate. You can lie. It's really fun. And also, I think the best part is multiple people can win. And I think most of the time, multiple people do win. So yeah. It's just like you don't feel bad for losing. You're not necessarily – I don't know. It's a really fun game and actually really simple when you kind of break it down, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
So, Cosmic Encounter.
Yeah, a lot of negotiation. There are unique different intergalactic races that you can be that all have unique powers. So no two games are alike. And no two strategies are alike, because you're playing with basically a different rule set than I'm playing with, because we have, a different special ability that we can do. Cosmic Encounter is really one of the classics and a great, great game. And I think it plays up to 8 people, doesn't it?
I think this one's only 5, but I'm sure there might be an expansion that does that. But
you're right, 5, yeah.
But I think it's a great transitional game as well. If you're like, okay, well, this person likes to play, Cards Against Humanity or whatever, very basic party games. Let's try to take a step before we get to something more intense. But I think it's that type of game, which is cool.
Again, that's called Cosmic Encounters.
Yeah. And then, have y'all talked about Star Wars Legion?
I have not played Star Wars Legion yet. I have 2 friends that have it. I've not been able to be at their house when it has been played, and I'm so jealous that you've got to play it. Is it awesome?
Yes, it is awesome. Have you played Warhammer? Have either of you played Warhammer?
A little, not very much.
Tiny amount, and then
So it's fine, because I used to hate Warhammer. My roommate here also loves Warhammer, super into it,
It's more than liking, it's more intimidated.
Yeah, the best part about Warhammer is rolling like 50 dice. Like, that's fun. But other than that, like, there's like armor, there's all these different checks. Yeah. Anyways, then they redid Warhammer about a year ago and made it simpler to where someone like me who's dumb can understand it. And I actually started to like Warhammer. And what Legion did was even make Warhammer better, essentially. So there's like, because now the very basic version is turns go back and forth. So instead of Warhammer, where it's like you do an entire movement action and combat and all this other kind of stuff in one turn, and then 30 minutes later, the next person gets to go. In Legion, movement simplified. So you move, and then the other person moves, and you can respond based on their movement and attack or whatever. So it's more of a give and take game, where Warhammer is more like passively, looking at it. Legion's great. If you like Warhammer, but you want something faster and simpler, I think go with Legion.
How does the IP play? Like, is it strong, like an inclusion, or is it just
you want to know the Star Wars-ness of it?
Yeah, do they capture that in a way, or is it just kind of the wrapper for the game that you're playing?
I would say it's probably the wrapper, to be honest. but it's Fantasy Flight. Like, they know what they're doing.
Good wrapper.
Yeah, but they could apply this to anything. The figures look fantastic. They're going to be really expensive, obviously. I think already there's like a $90 AT-AT. So it's just
– yeah.
So that's going to – it's an investment, kind of like Warhammer, but I think it'll pay off. And the base set is actually, I think, a good value, because you get a Rebel faction and an Empire faction and one of the bigger models, and you get Luke and Darth Vader. So I think – and that's like 60, 70. So I think for something like that, it's good. So yeah, if you like Warhammer, or if you've ever been intimidated by Warhammer, I think you might enjoy Legion.
Feels like being able to play Warhammer, like starting on the ground level. You know what I mean? Like, even the Warhammer lore feels intimidating. It's like, what are these factions?
Yes.
What's going on? There's a religion I need to know about for some reason. Yeah.
My friend,
the Bible. It's not as dense as the Bible, but also it's denser than the Bible. So that's it.
My friend talks about the Warhammer lore a lot, and he's like, well, what's great and awful about Warhammer lore is it's literally every trope in sci-fi it takes and just applies to its universe. So anything popular over the last 30 years is going to be wrapped into Warhammer universe.
Yeah, what if we just do that too? We'll just do it all.
As you said, though, it's been for 30 years. They've done an amazing job with keeping that franchise alive and, I think, relevant because of that stuff. Yeah. I think it's easy to kind of – almost make fun of or roll your eyes at because it's been a stalwart for so long. But at the same time, like, what other created IPs have spawned so many things and then also keep that core vision going, if that makes sense, where it didn't just become a video game or a comic or a movie, or, that became the thing that it's known for. It's like, it's still trucking along doing what it does, and it does it well.
Yeah. It is impressive, especially when you think about most games. It has you analyze strategy, but Warhammer is like, nope, it's tactics. It's tactics.
Yeah.
And that's different. It's more of a commitment, but they commit to it. It's great.
So I see on here, you also listed a game I don't know anything about. World Championship Roulette.
Yeah. I missed a word here. World Championship Russian Roulette.
Ah.
So it's been wedding season, which has been very fun, but like a lot of like traveling to Austin and, you know, just a lot of wedding events. And World Championship Russian Roulette has been played because it's A, a game a lot of people haven't played, and B, it's just really fun. I've rather you played it now that I put in the magic Russian word.
Is that when you're at a wedding and you put a gun on the table and you have the groom
yes.
spin and say, are you
no,
sure,
that's
dude?
A shotgun wedding.
It's like Deer Hunter. You guys are like a Deer Hunter wedding?
Yeah. No, it's really fun. Anthony Birch actually was a designer on it, I think. But it's – take the concept of Russian roulette where you have a – you have cards, right? And there are four blanks – or so there's six, right? There's six, and you can basically – there's a gun. There's a bang in it, and then there's blanks on the rest of them. And at the beginning of the turn, you pocket something. So you can either pocket a blank or you can pocket a bang. And then you bet how many times you're going to pull your gun. And so you can be like, I'm going to pull it two times and just risk it. Like, hopefully I won't, nothing will happen. Or you can be like, I'm going five, like just because you're an insane person. But if you say you're betting five, someone will probably call you out as a liar. And then you have to reveal if you're lying or not. And then, so it's really fun because there's that, you know, there's that phase where you're like, are they lying? I don't know. And then on top of that, there's that phase where everyone at the same time is flipping cards to see if they, you know, if they shoot themselves or not and then die for that round. And there's also powers involved that kind of build on top of each other. It's a really fun party game.
It's
World Championship Russian Roulette. I highly recommend it if you and your friends are looking for another game in that arsenal, because I think you can play with up to six people as well, which is pretty good for a party game.
Man, I have not heard of that game. That sounds awesome.
Yeah,
sounds
fun. I really like it. Really like it.
I have played Muse. Have you played Muse yet?
I have not.
So this is a party game that's sort of like Dixit. It's got these enigmatic looking, beautifully illustrated cards that are sort of, they look very dreamlike, these images that are not anything one thing specific, but they're, you know, it's like a rabbit and a sunset with, you know, giant lollipops and, you know, a ship in the background or something. It's these very strange images and a whole deck of these cards. And it's sort of like Dixit in teams. Dixit was that, where you were trying to get people to describe it, but not describe it too well. And that's kind of what you're doing with Muse. One team selects one of six of these cards in any given turn and says, we challenge somebody on your team to get your team to guess this card. And then there are a number of restriction cards that give you a special rule that make it harder for you to give clues. So, for example, you may only be able to draw something in the air with your finger, you know, like, or you'll only be able to make a shadow puppet, or, you know, you'll have to only say a word that starts with the letter C or something. So these weird rules. So what happens is the team whose turn it is, well, the one team selects the image that they have to get the other team to guess and selects the rule that they're going to apply. And then the other team, you know, has a person who sees that card, and then they lay down six cards, of which the one that was selected is one, and has to convey that image to their team, abiding by the special rule. And you have to see if your team guesses the right image. So a lot of wacky stuff can happen, and a lot of really bizarre clues that, you know, are trying to get you to look at these images. And some of them, you know, there'll be a rule like you can only use a color to tell the person what card it is. And so you really only have the colors to you know, choose from. So you're like green, but green is on every card and red is on every card. But what does one card like speak red? You know, is it like more red than the others? So it's fun. It's, you know, it makes you kind of have that outside the box thinking. And it's good because it's a team game. So you can really play infinite number of players, you know. And it's clever. I enjoy it. Dixit's a game I really love. It's in my collection. And Muse is a really fun twist on it as well.
Yeah, it all sounds like a evolution of code names as well.
Yes, yeah. Well, everybody's kind of doing their version of code names at this point.
That's
which
true.
Is cool.
I wonder why.
Yeah, yeah.
I played Marvel Code Names recently, by the way. Sorry to interject.
No.
That is hard. Marvel Code Names is hard.
Yeah?
because you're like, oh, I don't know as much about Marvel as I thought.
It's like, not all these are Dazzler. I don't understand.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I want to get to some quick questions really fast, but let us thank our final sponsor. This is a great one. This is a new sponsor I'm really excited about. And what a week for this sponsor. Sherry's Berries is the sponsor. And it's, I'm being completely honest with you in saying they became a sponsor this week. I had a child, a new baby girl named Zoe, very proud of her, and brought her home from the hospital this week. And what was waiting for us at our house when we got there was a box of Sherry's Berries. You think, oh, well, obviously it's because you're being sponsored by Sherry's Berries. No, no, no. My wife's grandma sent us Sherry's Berries as a gift. And I tell you, we got flowers from a lot of people. We got lovely cards. My favorite gift was the Sherry's Berries because, you know, flowers are nice and all. My wife likes flowers. They die. They were around for a while. They looked pretty. Sherry's Berries is straight up delicious. That is the gift to give you. And you got Mother's Day coming up. I'm telling you, give your mom some Sherry's Berries. It's better than flowers. Everybody's giving their mom flowers. Sherry's Berries comes beautifully. We loved unwrapping it and comes in this cool, like, padded box that keeps the berries cold and fresh. And these are not your typical strawberries. And honestly, Sherry's Berries has a whole bunch of stuff other than the strawberries. We happened to get the strawberries from my wife's grandmother, and I loved them because they are chocolate dipped strawberries. These are gigantic, huge, and delicious. And we got the variety pack with dark chocolate, white chocolate, and milk chocolate with nuts on it. Oh my God, they're so good. They're so good. I loved them. And I think this is going to be my go-to gift from now on because it's so much better. And not everybody is doing it, right? Not everybody – everybody sends flowers. Not everybody sends a delicious treat that you can enjoy that tastes great but also is fresh and really feels good to eat, feels decadent. And right now – you can get Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Or check this out. You can also double the berries for just $10 more. There's a special promotion right now because you listen to this show. Double the berries, $19.99 plus shipping for some delicious Sherry's Berries. Or double the berries for just $10 more. They'll arrive in the Sherry's Berries signature gift box with a beautiful ribbon. No gift wrap is required. These are delicious. And there's only one way to get this amazing deal for your mom, for Mother's Day, for your loved ones, freshly dipped strawberries starting at $19.99 plus shipping and handling, and you can double the berries for $10 more. Mother's Day on May 13th, so visit berries.com, berries.com today, and click the mic in the upper right-hand corner and then enter code DLC. So you got to click on that mic. Don't forget to do that, and you'll get this special offer. That's berries.com. And the code DLC on that mic in the upper right corner. All right, we're going to do some quick questions. These are submitted by listeners either on our Reddit at 5x5dlc.reddit.com or at our email address, which is dlcfeedback@gmail.com. First one comes from Charlie from New Jersey. He says, hey, guys, quick question. How long is too long for a game to get good? For instance, I heard someone say that if you could get through the first 4 to 6 hours of Assassin's Creed Origins, it got really good. Is that too much time to invest to hope that a game gets good? Brandon, you just started Assassin's Creed Origins. I don't know if that game isn't good yet for you, but is there too much to invest in a game before it gets good?
Yes, I think so, and I think that all has to do with how the developer – teases out the world and the mechanics. So what that means is when someone says it's not good, they mean it's not fun. So that means they haven't got their very core-ness fun yet, and they should have introduced that sooner. Like an example actually from Sunset Overdrive is I think it took a little too long to get the air dash in the game because the air dash is behind about 2 hours of content. And yeah, when you have the air dash, like the game opens up and becomes really fun. So I would have actually, like in retro, you know, armchair game designer right here, but like I think at that point people will be like, oh, it gets really good when you get air dash. And it's like, okay, well, on the second time around, let's have air dash right from the beginning because then that's where it, quote, gets good.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it depends.
This is the equivalent of you got to get through season one of Buffy, right? You got to get through season one. You got to get through season one. Christian, do you have how long is too long for a game to get good?
I don't know if I have a number of hours per se, but it's just Final Fantasy.
I was going to say the same thing.
Whatever that always takes.
Yeah. No, there's never been a Final Fantasy game that you don't have to endure several hours before it gets good. Ni No Kuni 2 is like that for me this year too, where I was like, oh, this is the game. And then 2 hours later, oh, this is the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of Japanese style role-playing games really take their time setting things up. Or better example, I know this is blasphemy for a lot of people listening, but you guys know how I feel about Persona 5. That game took too long to get good, and I was done. I couldn't invest in the getting good.
Yeah. I think Monster Hunter does a great job at it, because that's a game with a billion systems, but their core mechanic, all the stuff was introduced right up front, and you're immediately hooked.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Brandon's point is good. It's a great one too, though. It's about like, you're not having fun with it versus get good. To some extent, I think Destiny 2 or both Destinies kind of suffered from that also.
Beat the game before it gets good. Yeah.
Right. And it's not, I don't know if it's necessarily get good per se. Maybe this is changing the question a little bit. So sorry, Charlie. I realized I was saying sorry, Charlie, as I said it. Sorry again, Charlie, for that. But it's, when does the game shift into the thing that everyone will be talking about? Because the first part of Destiny, I think, is good. But when people talk about Destiny, that's not what they're talking about. It's that end game, what are you doing for the rest of your life or for the rest of the month kind of content. And that, I think, is a slightly different question, because the first part can be fun, but you're almost rushing through it to get to the end game. And then I think if I were to assign a kind of arbitrary hour mark, I think it should be under 8. Enough to get your feet wet.
Yeah, for sure.
But not so much that, you know, you have to make a serious commitment to it.
I think it's got to be under 2. I think it's got to be in that first hour. You got to get hooked in some way. You know, I really do think that. All right. Second one. This comes from Craig Rapp. He says, a quick question. What does it take for you to jump into a series you haven't played early installments of, or are unfamiliar with the lore? For example, the new God of War and The Witcher 3 both come highly recommended, but part of me hates jumping into something when there's a prior story that I'm unfamiliar with. Do you have a rule of thumb for jumping into a series that's ongoing? Brandon?
I'm not sure. Usually I won't jump in if it's like super story tied, I guess. I'll try to go back and play, but like DMC, Devil May Cry, I love that game. Never played the old ones, and that was purely based on the repertoire of the developer.
Yeah.
Just because I was like, oh, I love that developer. This looks like a lot of fun. I'll hop in. But story-wise, I don't think I've ever really done that where I've just like jumped in.
Yeah, I do not care about this with video games, which is weird. Like I wouldn't do it with a TV show. I wouldn't do it with a sequel to a movie. I'd feel like I need to see the first movie. Video games, I do not care. I recommend people play whatever the game is that they want to play. You don't need to play the other ones first. I just don't think you need to. I think most video games, because they're such big, deep, long experiences, they tend to be episodic in nature anyway. I mean, even the Uncharted games, I was just like, if you want to play 4, play 4. It's a complete story. You don't, I mean, yeah, there's stuff maybe, but I don't think you need to.
I think you'll also hit fatigue.
Yeah.
As well, if you do that.
Anyways. I would say the same thing applies to movies and TV shows. I think the difference is you wouldn't tell someone to come in on the 5th level of Uncharted 4. You would say play Uncharted 4. So a TV show, wait for a new season. But the best shows, or most great shows and competent shows, do audience onboarding on a new season, because they know that's when people will be jumping on. And movies are the same way. People, should I see Infinity War? Yes. I haven't seen any of the other Marvel movies. Okay. Does this one look good to you? Yes. Go see it. You'll have fun. And I think that applies for video games also. I wouldn't tell someone to say, you should play Telltale's Walking Dead, start with episode 3.
Right.
You know, it's like, if you want to play season 1, you need to play season 1 to play season 2? No.
But like,
you can jump in.
One of my favorite shows on TV right now is Last Man on Earth. And even starting a new season, I think people jumping in that would be like, this is gobbledygook. This doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I was like, it so builds on previous seasons that I just can't imagine anybody just stumbling on the show is like, what the hell is even happening with this thing?
Well, I can tell you the network wants people to stumble on it and find and start. Yeah, I know they'll select, you know, stream on the app to catch up or whatever, but shows every season, the way most, and maybe it's changing now with Netflix a little bit, but I think even with them, the way shows are structured, it's every new season is the new 52, right? Yeah. Every season is right. Superman number one again, where they do a little bit of retconning if they need to, and then onboard the audience and start a new arc to get people excited. And even ones shows like Justified that maybe have one long story arc throughout it, each season is self-contained enough. But to answer Craig's question, yeah, no. Play if a game seems exciting to you, play it.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters to go back.
All right, last one. This comes from David from Washington, D.C. He says, quick question. You talked about having to not spend a lot of time with a game because you have to move on to the next game. If you could go back, or if you could go on sabbatical from everything for 6 months, what past games would you go back to? Brendan, it sounds like you're kind of doing this in a way.
Yeah. I absolutely loved Dragon Age Origins before I went home for Christmas. And then I played like, I think 30 hours of it and was obsessed with it for a week. And then when I got back home, all of a sudden there was this monumental shift in my gameplay where I hated open world games. So I think I really actually want to go back and try that one again because I'm a little more open to open world games.
You can play that game for 30 hours and not leave the hinterlands.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There was so much. And then it was this weird point where I got back to it and I just got, cause I went through a phase where I got super stressed out by open world games. Just because of you could do anything and I really hated that. But now I would want to go back to that one.
Christian, how about you? You got a game or two that you would return to if you were free to play anything?
I mean, that is a great question and one that gives me a little bit of anxiety thinking about all the great things I didn't finish that I want to and set out to. I'm doing it a little bit with Breath of the Wild right now. So that, you know, I do enjoy my time with that game. But honestly, I think I would want to go back to, the 16-bit era and finish some of those restart. Cause I don't know where I left off. But I think I'd want to play like some old, like Final Fantasy III. I never finished.
Wow. So you go in the Wayback Machine.
Yeah, that the first Super NES one, or is that still still NES?
I don't know.
I don't know. I could be getting the number.
It takes too long to get good in that game.
But some of those is what I would go back to. It's like me and only a retro console to make me do it, because otherwise I get distracted by new and shiny, and a lot of those games do take time to build. I'd want to play Super Metroid again. What I would. I'd bring my SNES Classic back with me. Is what I would do.
Not me, man. I got games now that, I mean, I think that the thing that I would do if I could literally just take 6 months to just not have any responsibilities whatsoever, right at this moment, I would play Skyrim in VR with all the mods. Ooh. You know, just replay Skyrim, but do it in VR. I just can't find the time to fit that 100 hours into my life with all the other things going on.
You don't have to take care of your kid if you can't see your kid.
That's the rule. That's the first rule of parenting is, is cover my eyes and they disappear. I think that would be the big one that I would go. But I also never finished the Witcher 3 Blood and Wine expansion, which was really good. I'd love to go back and do that. And I'm sure there's like six other things that are still in my Steam library that I haven't, that I was like, I'll go back to that. I won't uninstall it. And then, you know, it sits there. Anyway, great question though. Thanks everybody. Again, you can send those to dlcfeedback@gmail.com or post them on our subreddit. But that is going to do it for this episode of DLC. We do have a parting gift coming up, so stick around for that. But Brandon Winfrey, thank you so much for being here, my friend.
Thank you all. I really enjoyed it. It was fun.
Where can people keep up with you and what you're doing on the internet?
Just B Winfrey on Twitter and Instagram. I'll be there. I'm trying to be more active on social media. I kind of flew away from it for a little bit. But yeah, I think I wrote video game raps recently, and I think those videos will come out in like June or something.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
Yeah. Really random.
Christian, we heard a little bit about what you are doing with regard to St. Jude's, but anything else you want to plug?
No, I'll get a schedule up for when I'm going to be streaming, playing some of those retro games I got back from my folks' house. Speaking of spending 6 months with retro games, for some of the streams I'll be doing for Play Live. So look to Twitter, which is just @Spicer, or my website, christianspicer.com, when I get that schedule up. And while you're there, you can donate to St. Jude and help sick kids battle cancer.
Awesome. I have other shows, including We Have Concerns, which is a comedy science show. You should check it out. It's only 20-minute episodes. You can find them at weHaveConcerns.com. And I also have a movie and TV review show called Slash Filmcast. This week, we're talking about what else? Avengers Infinity War. Not going to want to miss that episode. Should be a really good one. You can find that at slashfilmcast.com. All right, guys, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gift.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Brandon, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Yeah, Black Lightning is now on Netflix. Check it out. It's good, and I think it deals with topics in a way that maybe Luke Cage, that Luke Cage kind of skirted around. Black Lightning kind of takes it on directly. It's interesting.
Awesome. Black Lightning on Netflix. Very good. Christian, how about you? You got a parting gift?
Yeah, it's an older show. I already mentioned it once in this episode, but what got me back into it was Far Cry 5, actually, but Justified.
Oh, all so good!
Six seasons? All seasons are on Amazon Prime, and so you can get in and binge all of them before they raise the rates of Amazon Prime on us all here in a little bit. Yeah. But it is really well done.
Great ending too, man. Not many seasons or series wrap up so well. And God, I'm such an Oliphant. I love him.
Yeah, it's Timothy Oliphant as your main protagonist and Walter Goggins as your main antagonist, who you might know from The Shield, which is also excellent. But they're all on Amazon Prime.
My favorite line from Justified, which has so many great lines, but my favorite line from Justified is he takes a bullet in his fingers and he tosses it at a guy at his chest and he goes, "The next one's going to come at you a lot faster."
Yeah,
it's good.
It's full of them, like. Yeah. What are you gonna do, kill me? No, you're gonna wish I killed you. And like, it's said so early and then pays off so well. Yeah. It's really well written, and a lot of people won awards for it as well. It's a well done show.
So we got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. it comes from Jake Brozovic. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He says, when listening to this week to Christian talk about Nintendo Labo and the joy his daughter was getting from it, it made me think of a series of children's books by author Peter Reynolds. This is for listeners with young children who want some inspiring stories that spark conversations with your little one. I thought that both you and Christian would love to share these with your children, and congrats on the newest Kanata edition. Ah, thank you, Jake. The book that most relates is Going Places, which is about a boy who is so excited to get constructing his go-kart, but learns that following instructions might not always lead the place you think. The other two books that relate is one called Dot and another called Ish. Both have similar themes to Going Places, but build on the conversation. Ish is about being good-ish at things, while Dot is to do with the idea that art is in the eye of the beholder. All three books are truly important to share with young kids as you guide them on their journey to adulthood. Your local library, which has appeared as a parting gift before, is a wonderful place to let kids explore these books. Awesome. Thanks, Jake. Very, very cool. Again, those are from Peter Reynolds, the author of those books. My parting gift is an HBO documentary series that is two parts. Both are 2 hours long. It's from Judd Apatow, and it's called The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. And it blew me away. I watched it over the last two nights with my wife and mom, who is in town because of the birth of our child. And we were all just riveted. It is inspiring. It is beautiful. It is a window into an artist that I admired very, very deeply based on his two TV shows and stand-up career. But the insight into who he was as a person, his goodness, really a guy who made the world a better place in a lot of ways, complicated and interesting. Just a great documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling on HBO. All right, that's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Brandon Winfrey and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to all of you in our chat rooms over there at caffeine.tv/Jeff Cannata and twitch.tv/Christian Spicer for hanging out with us in real time and making the show better. We also want to thank our musical contributors, which are Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for making those cool bumpers that you hear between segments. And thanks to all of you who download the show. It means a lot to us. It makes the show work. We appreciate it. We'll be with you next week. As always, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.